I want to talk about spin dynamics of whole systems. This work was done in collaboration with Nini Kulcher and Christian Lechner, and the experiments I'm going to talk about were done in the group of Mansoor Shaigan at Princeton University. Yeah, what's the deal about holes? What does holes make different from electron systems, you might ask? The main thing of holes as compared to electrons in typical semiconductors is that they are characterized by an effective spin 3/2 as compared to the electrons the way we know them being particles with a spin 1/2. Where does this spin 3/2 come from? In a simple tight binding picture for the band structure of common semiconductors like gallium arsenide and others, the conduction band is made from S-like atomic orbitals, whereas the valence band is made from P-like atomic orbitals, angular momentum 1. So if we add spin, we get 3/2 states and 1/2 states here in the valence band that are split by the spin orbit gap delta, whereas here the electrons, they remain spin 1/2 particles in the usual way. This becomes an issue, say, when we put these electrons and holes into a quantum well where we get bound states as I've shown them here. The electron spins and the light hole spins, yeah, I forgot to say this, we have the 3/2 states which for finite k vectors split into heavy hole and light hole, heavy hole with plus minus 3/2 and light hole with plus minus 1/2. And now the electrons and the light hole states, they are essentially decoupled. These spins can point any direction they like. This is qualitatively different for the heavy hole states. The heavy hole states with a spin z component plus minus 3/2. For these heavy hole states, the spin orientation is fixed by the subband quantization that we have. These heavy hole spins are always pointing perpendicular to the 2D plane. And this becomes an issue, for example, when an in-plane magnetic field is applied, an in-plane magnetic field that wants to orient the spins in-plane. This can be done with the electron and light hole spins, but essentially nothing can be done with the heavy hole spins. They hardly respond at all to the in-plane magnetic field. Yeah. I already told you about this issue of spin 1/2 electrons versus spin 3/2 holes. I want to go on and discuss in a little more detail the Zeeman splitting and spin polarization of 2D hole systems in an in-plane magnetic field. I want to go on and talk about exchange correlation enhancement of Zeeman splitting. And yeah, we will have some surprises there, which I want to discuss using a multiple expansion of the spin density matrix for these spin 3/2 hole systems. And then at the end of the talk, I want to switch somewhat gears and use this language that I have developed here in order to discuss a very different subject, namely spin precession of 3/2 spin 3/2 hole systems. Yeah, Let me briefly remind you of how we can use Zeeman energy splitting to create a spin polarized system. At a zero magnetic field, we have equal occupations of the two spin subbands up and down. Now, when we apply an in-plane magnetic field, of course, we do not get Landau levels, but the Zeeman splitting will increase the occupation of one spin subband, and it will decrease the occupation of the other spin subband. And yeah, when the Zeeman splitting becomes larger than the Fermi energy, the electron system will be fully spin polarized, and this can be measured, for example, by looking at the magnetoresistance. The point is now for the spin 3/2-hole systems, they are qualitatively different from what this simple picture suggests. Yeah, I already told you about the frozen spin that we have for the heavy hole states being oriented always perpendicular to the plane, 2D plane of the quantum well. So it has been known actually for quite some time that there is no Zeeman splitting linear in the magnetic field. The G factor for the heavy holes for an in-plane magnetic field is essentially zero. If we look at this in a little more detail, what we find is that the Zeeman splitting that we can get in the system is a higher order effect. It is in lowest order, it is cubic in the magnetic field. We get an energy denominator, which is the heavy hole, light hole splitting. The more we separate the plus minus 3/2 states from the plus minus 1/2 light hole states, the more tightly bound the heavy hole states will be with their spin orientation perpendicular to the 2D plane. Yeah, a different way of saying this is that the Zeeman splitting of the heavy hole states competes with the heavy hole light hole splitting. And if you insert typical numbers, what you find is that the heavy hole light hole splitting is much larger than the energies that can be achieved due to the magnetic field. So, yeah, it's only a small correction that we get due to the in-plane field. This can be seen nicely in an experiment where one studies the depopulation of the minority spin subband due to an in-plane magnetic field. As I said, the quantity of experimental interest is then the magnetoresistance. And essentially, what one can measure is the magnetic field that is required for a complete depopulation here of the minority spin subband. And the data that I want to show you here was obtained for a single heterojunction with a fixed density, but an electric field was applied that changed the shape of the confining potential from such a more shallow potential to such a steeper potential. And yeah, plotted here is the depopulation field as a function of electric field. And we see that the depopulation field increases significantly as a function of electric field. And we can immediately understand this result using the picture that I introduced before. Here for the shallow confinement, we have a small heavy hole, light hole splitting, which translates into a large Zeeman splitting, so that we get a small depopulation field. On the other hand, for the large heavy hole, light hole splitting, we get a small Zeeman splitting, and we get a large depopulation field. So what is then actually the spin polarization that we get? I told you that we have essentially this frozen spin of the heavy holes, and we just slightly change those spins when the in-plane magnetic field is applied. This is shown here in a figure where for a realistic system, the upper figure shows the depopulation of the spin subband, the minority band, as a function of field, and the lower figure here shows the actual spin polarization that we get. And by just comparing those two figures, we see here immediately that for these whole systems, the Zeeman energy splitting, which is essentially monitored here, is not simply related with the spin polarization we have. Because of this frozen spin, we have the spin polarization is always much smaller than 1, even when here at about, in this case, 25 Tesla, the minority spin subband is, this thing is working every now and then it doesn't work anymore. Yeah, when here it is completely depopulated, the spin polarization is of the order of 0.15, much smaller than 1. And the most surprising thing in this figure is actually that for weak magnetic fields, we get a spin polarization anti-parallel to the magnetic field, and only for larger fields, the spin polarization will be parallel to the field. This can be understood nicely. I don't want to go into the details. You can find it in there.
This was including that mixing.
This is the numerical calculation that is shown here includes all the fancy details of the heavy hole band structure. Yes, and this is essentially an average of the spin orientation over all occupied states. And averaged as a function of magnetic field. You might ask yourself, why are these experiments interesting? Why do people study this depopulation of the minority spin subband? And one of the main reasons was that it's known for dilute electron systems that the spin susceptibility, the response to the magnetic field is enhanced because of exchange correlation. And we get a large enhancement for small densities, essentially for dilute systems and for large effective masses. Large effective masses means that such experiments should be done with holes instead of electrons, just because holes are known to have typically much larger masses than electron systems. So this should be a nice playground to study these many particle effects. And indeed, such experiments have been done by many groups. There are yet more reasons to study these spin phenomena, because, for example, we know that holes mediate the ferromagnetism in gallium manganese arsenide and not the electrons. So definitely it will be helpful to understand these holes. And also, more recently, holes have become a very hot topic in the context of the spin Hall effect. So, yeah, here I want to discuss the spin susceptibility of dilute 2D systems. Here is plotted essentially the enhancement of spin susceptibility due to exchange correlation. The enhancement as a function of the dimensionless density parameter RS, which is essentially 1 over square root of density. So a large RS means a dilute system. And the data point here, which corresponds to RS between about 3 and about 7, we see here that the enhancement of the spin susceptibility due to exchange correlation is between here about factor of 2 up to about a factor of 4. And the calculated solid curve suggests that if we go to yet more dilute systems, larger RS, we expect a huge enhancement of the spin susceptibility due to exchange correlation. And this density parameter RS is proportional to the effective mass, so that we do expect for the heavier hole systems as compared to the electron systems, we should be able to explore the regime up here showing a large enhancement of the spin susceptibility. And here comes the big surprise. The experimental data for the hole system has the large RS value that we expect to get. But the data points are down here, showing that essentially there is no enhancement whatsoever. Here, the calculation had to take into account for the electrons in exchange correlation in order to model the measured spin susceptibility. Here, the calculation for the whole systems did not take into account any exchange correlation, and it just gives the measured depopulation field. And all this despite the very large RS we have in these whole systems. So the big question to ask here, why is exchange correlation in whole systems very different from electron systems? And the way I want to discuss this is using a spin density matrix approach, which for spin 1/2 electrons is fairly simple. The electrons are characterized by a 2x2 spin density matrix, which is essentially then characterized by 4 independent parameters, the density and the vector of spin polarization. And the language I want to use is a multipole expansion, as I like to call it, where we have a monopole that corresponds to the charge density, and a dipole that corresponds to the spin polarization, the way we know it for these electron systems. We can compare this with the Hamiltonian for such a spin one-half systems, where we have one part that is diagonal in spin space that gives us essentially the dynamics of the charge density, and we have also something like a Zeeman term which gives us the spin polarization at a finite magnetic field. The important point here is for the spin one-half electrons that the orbital and spin dynamics are decoupled, because the wave functions can be factorized into an orbital part and a spin part. Now I want to use the same approach for the whole systems. We have a 4x4 spin density matrix now with 16 independent parameters, and this is very complex, and for a long time nobody wanted to deal with this spin density matrix at all. I believe that the multipole expansion that I proposed on the previous slide really helps to approach this problem. We have now four multipoles. Once again, we have the monopole that corresponds to the charge density, a dipole that corresponds to the spin polarization at a finite magnetic field. But in addition, we get two more multipoles. We get a quadrupole that corresponds to the heavy hole light hole splitting, which is, by the way, very nice thing. We already saw earlier in this talk that the heavy hole light hole splitting does play an important role if we want to understand what's going on in these systems. So it's naturally incorporated here. And then we also get an octopole moment, which, like the spin polarization, is only present if there is a magnetic field applied. We can compare this once again with the Hamiltonian that we use to describe the system. For these whole systems, the Hamiltonian is well known, the Luttinger Hamiltonian, which contains a kinetic energy and potential term. This is the part which is diagonal in spin space. We get a dipole term, which is the Zeeman term. We get a quadrupole term that describes the heavy hole light hole split. It is an effective spin orbit term that we have in this Hamiltonian. Yeah, the octopole term is usually negligible. The prefactor of it can be evaluated, but it is significantly smaller than the other terms.
Would this be the warping then?
The warping is completely neglected in this approach. I'm using here a spherical model. It is essentially the language that was developed 30 years ago by Baldareschi and Lipari, that you decompose the Hamiltonian into a spherical part and a small cubic correction. And here I'm discussing only the spherical part. The cubic terms are really a small correction in the present context.
Let's see, you assume that gamma 2 equals gamma 3?
Essentially,
and then
yes.
Gamma 1 equals gamma 2 equals gamma
3. Gamma 1 gives me the diagonal term, and gamma 2, gamma 3 give me the heavy hole, light hole splitting, and for the spherical approximation, I assume essentially that they are equal, yes.
Then I don't quite understand. How can you get from 16 independent parameters suddenly into 4 independent parameters? You must have lost something.
What do you mean 4 independent parameters? The monopole is a scalar. The dipole is a 3-component vector. The quadrupole is a 5-component vector. And the octopole is a 7-component. Very same thing we know from electrodynamics.
Right. So you still have 16 independent
certainly,
parameters.
Certainly.
You have grouped them in a different way.
Yes, yeah. Group them in a way that has a physical interpretation.
Okay.
Just like for the spin one-half electrons, the spin polarization has a clear physical interpretation. We have here now a physical picture for these terms that we get.
And you're assuming version symmetry.
Here I'm not talking about any potentials or like that. It's all in the spherical approximation, which yes implies inversion symmetry. The things are more complicated, however, for the whole systems because the dynamics of the multipoles are coupled to each other. The wave functions cannot be factorized into a monopole part, a dipole part, a quadrupole part, and an octopole part. That would be nice, but it's just not possible. And this has very important consequences. And to illustrate this, I want to go back once more to these depopulation experiments, where here, as a function of density, is plotted the magnetic field required to completely depopulate the minority spin subband, and the solid curve without exchange correlation taken into account matches nicely the experimental data. And the right figure now here shows the normalized multipole moments that we have at the depopulation field, so when the minority spin subband is completely depopulated. We see here, first of all, that the quadrupole moment, the quadrupole that corresponds to the heavy hole light hole splitting, is still very close to one, which means with the in-plane magnetic field, we have hardly changed anything in that respect. Next, let's look at the dipole moment we get. The dipole moment, or the spin polarization. The spin polarization is very small, less than 0.2. And finally, we do not have an octopole in the Hamiltonian, but we do have a large octopole in the spin density matrix, which is essentially due to the fact that these different multipoles are coupled, and we can call this octopole moment a new degree of freedom for the whole spins in the presence of an in-plane magnetic field. Now, what one will need in order to go on here is a parametrization of the exchange correlation energy as a function of all four multipoles. For the spin 1/2 electrons, this is well established. People like, what's his name in Urbana-Champaign? David Zepperly has done these fancy Monte Carlo calculations in order to evaluate the exchange correlation energy as a function of density and spin polarization for the spin 1/2 electron systems. What we do need now in order to understand better the whole systems is a parametrization of the exchange correlation energy as a function of these four multipoles, which are really the four independent parameters characterizing the whole system. A whole system with, say, a large heavy hole, light hole splitting cannot be translated into a whole system with, say, a large spin polarization. This would always mean comparing apples with oranges. Unfortunately, this big thing has not been done up to now. So what I want to do is continue now in a rather different direction. I want to look at a spin precession. And to begin with, I want to look once more at the familiar case of a spin 1/2 electrons, where we have a Hamiltonian like this one, I just assumed here some effective Zeeman term. Magnetic field B that appears here can be either an external magnetic field, like we discussed it before, or it can also be an effective magnetic field, say due to a Dresselhaus spin orbit coupling or a Rushbaugh spin orbit coupling. And then we can study here the equation of motion for the spin vector, and you all know the result. We get the famous spin precession equation, where we have a spin vector that precesses around the magnetic field. The equation is very simple. The magnitude of the spin vector is preserved during this process, and in this time-dependent picture, the spin vector is often called the Bloch vector. And I just want to remind you that if, say, this effective magnetic field is the Dresselhaus field, which is k-dependent, we get the well-known Yakunov-Perel spin relaxation. This Hamiltonian in the language that I used before is just the monopole and the dipole for the spin 3/2 whole systems. It becomes more complicated. We have the monopole, the dipole, and the quadrupole. We can usually ignore the octopole. And what do we get? Just to give you a flavor of what you can get, I have ignored here the dipole term. There is no effective magnetic field or external magnetic field. I also ignored the octopole term. Essentially, in this figure, I have taken into account only the term that describes heavy hole, light hole splitting. And essentially this was done by assuming a k-vector as shown here, a k-vector in the xz plane. And initially I assumed that a heavy hole, a plus 3/2 spin, was pointing in the z direction. And then I evaluated this Heisenberg equation of motion for this spin vector pointing in z direction, and what you get is this green curve shown here, which in particular gives us a spin polarization where the magnitude of the spin polarization is oscillating. Here this is not conserved, unlike the case of electrons. And all this happens at zero magnetic field. In a more formal way, the time derivative of the spin polarization, as it appears here in the Heisenberg equation of motion, it gives us a dipole moment, a quadrupole moment, and an octopole moment. And of course, this figure shows us only the dipole moment, because I haven't yet found a convenient way to plot the five-component quadrupole moment and the seven-component octopole moment. But if we could easily visualize this, it would be a figure similar to this one. To discuss this from a somewhat different perspective, I want to study a device that was recently fabricated by Matt Grayson and co-workers at the Technical University in Munich in Germany a corner device where essentially a 2D channel, a 2D plane is half infinite and a half infinite 2D plane perpendicular connected to this, so that we just get a corner as it is shown here. Yeah, unfortunately, Grayson's experiment up to now were only done with n-type material with electrons, and I hope that soon he will also do such experiments with holes. Yes?
Well, I'm still struggling with the previous line. Can you repeat the statement about what we expect about holes? Do we expect any precessions going on?
This is in a generalized sense, the spin precession you get for whole systems essentially by evaluating, like it's done here for the electron spin 1/2, you evaluate the Heisenberg equation of motion, or you can also just evaluate the time evolution operator for the spin operator. It's all the same.
What do you expect as an answer? I didn't understand your
What I expect here at zero magnetic field when I start out with such a spin vector is a spin polarization that oscillates as a function of time, oscillates in the sense that the amplitude of the spin polarization goes up and down in time.
So what oscillations between light poles and heavy poles, that's what you're saying.
I simply evaluate the expectation value of the spin operator for a given initial state. And say for the electron system, when I evaluate this expectation value as a function of time, the magnitude of the spin vector is preserved. It's just this very well-known picture that we have, say, a unit spin vector to begin with, and it is precessing, and along this precessional motion, it will always remain a unit vector. When it's here, it's a unit vector, and when it's here, it's still a unit vector. And the point about the holes is that when you evaluate this expectation value, it's not constant in magnitude as a function of time, but it is essentially shifted back and forth between these different terms that, say initially we have a large dipole and a small quadrupole and octupole, and then after half the period this will be redistributed among the moments, and when you complete period, it will again redistribute.
But what would it be correct to say that you're talking about oscillations between the heavy hole and the light hole?
Heavy hole and light hole in this context here corresponds to no spin polarization. The point is really that in this case, I just start out with a four-component vector, which is like this. If this is the plus 3/2 component, plus 1/2, minus 1/2, and minus 3/2, and I take the Luttinger Hamiltonian for a k vector, as shown here by the blue arrow. And then I evaluate this equation of motion and take the expectation value with this state.
Well, then, for example, a hole which is injected by polarized light excitation.
For example,
and
correct.
T equals zero.
Yeah.
The spin of the hole has a total angular momentum 3 times.
Yeah.
So how does the magnitude of this change?
The magnitude of the spin polarization is you really have to take this expectation value. You can either evaluate you can either use the Heisenberg picture and evaluate the equation of motion for the spin operator, or equally well, you can use the time-dependent Schrödinger equation and evaluate the evolution in time for this initial state.
You're talking about an ensemble of spins.
Right now, I'm essentially only talking about one individual spin, but you can also, of course, generalize it to an ensemble of spins, or you can assume that you just have a bunch of spins, all with a plus, all only with a plus 3/2 component. That doesn't make a difference.
But the k vector of the whole is also important to us.
I mean, it specifies the geometry of the system, and maybe this becomes clearer in the next figure, where I assume that I have an incoming beam of holes, here in this upper half infinite plane, and I assume magnetic field zero. So instead of this instead of this initial state, I have essentially this, and to make the density matrix complete, I also have, of course, this state. And if I have an equal superposition of these states, it's an unpolarized system. It's an unpolarized heavy hole system. Or I can also write it in that way. That's, of course, fully equivalent. Doesn't make a difference. So this is my my incoming hole beam, and the hole states that I have are essentially eigenstates of the Hamiltonian that I have up here.
Only for k equals zero.
The in-plane k vector in this context is a very small perturbation. I just assume that there is some small in-plane k vector, but essentially the eigenstates will still be more or less like this. The point is that when these states reach here, the corner, and they continue moving down here, they are not eigenstates of the system anymore. This is all certainly a dynamical thing. We are talking here about what non-eigenstates are doing. Initially, I have eigenstates up here, but when I put the eigenstates for the part L1 into the layer L2, they are not eigenstates anymore. And what these non-eigenstates do is that they start to precess. This is what we had here. Those states, when I superpose them, have no spin polarization. They also have no octopole moment. But when I put these states into region L2 and just once again evaluate the Schrödinger equation or Heisenberg equation in this particular geometry, there is no spin polarization, but there is a quadrupole moment and an octopole moment which oscillates as a function of time, and the oscillation frequency is essentially once again the heavy hole light hole splitting that we have in the system.
If you look at this as a transport problem,
yeah.
On the left you have the reservoir and below you have the reservoir.
Uh-huh.
You could look at this problem at least in linear response, just with sort of Landau and Wichita type of picture, which is completely DC. You do not need any frequency there. You've got some backscattering at this corner, which depends, of course, on the band structure, but there is no time dependence.
Think about it in terms of a wave packet, say.
Yeah, but as long as linear response, then you don't need that, right?
you have a wave packet made of these spin components, and you put this wave packet into the region L2, and the wave packet, the spin components of the wave packet are not eigenstates of the Hamiltonian characterizing this region L2. And what you get is spin precession in, of course, a ballistic sense.
What is omega?
To get what you're doing is sort of you're pushing, for example, a laser light pulse on the left, and you excite a wave packet and you see how this develops.
Omega 2, omega that appears here is essentially H-bar over a heavy hole, light hole splitting.
In the previous slide, it was a 3D bark picture that you showed, right?
Let me go back.
So there, you know, the precession depends on your K, essentially.
The K translates into the KZ for the standing waves that I get in the 2D system. So in that sense, it's fully consistent. I can either talk about a K, or I can talk about a heavy hole, light hole, split in,
But in a standing wave, you have a K going left, you get a K going right. So is there not a no compensation sort of going on in this higher?
For the equations of motion, no. Because what happens is that you, anyway, in the Luttinger Hamiltonian, you have kz squared. So it drops out.
Do you mean that you cannot diagonalize in this gamma geometry, you cannot find eigenstates?
Certainly you can, but the point is about this corner device, the way I look at it, that you start out with an eigenstate for the region L1, and the eigenstate for region L1 is injected into region L2, where it is not an eigenstate anymore.
So at the level of wave packets, it makes perfect sense, but if you actually solve Schrodinger equation with this geometry, you're going to get some eigenstates, right, which are going to be some funny spin states.
I mean, this is certainly something in a more refined approach, what we want to do. Those are somewhat simplistic arguments. I mean, you can approach that problem from a different point of views. What we really initially started out with was just to look at the Heisenberg equation of motion for the different parts of the Luttinger Hamiltonian and see what kind of multipoles we get here on the right hand side of the equation if on the left hand side, say, we have only a spin polarization or only a quadrupole moment. And then different parts of the Hamiltonians like these ones. And what you find, say, is when you start out with a quadrupole moment, is there some chalk? You take the quadrupole dt and you evaluate I h bar H2, the quadrupole part of the Hamiltonian, which gives you the heavy hole, light hole split in. This gives you essentially a spin polarization plus an octupole moment. The point is that when you take this equation of motion for the spin part and you evaluate this commutator, the commutator gives you once again the spin vector S. And the difference here is that we start out with this quadrupole operator, evaluate the commutator, and essentially the equations of motions are not closed. Here, for the spin 1/2 electrons, it's all within spin, or dipole, as I call it. And here, the right-hand side gives us the dipole and the octupole, even though essentially the quadrupole decays into a dipole and an octupole when you evaluate the equation of motion.
So would it be fair to say, to translate this picture into the transport van der Wittig sort of picture that Gerrit is referring to, if you solve the transmission problem, you will find generalized deflection transmission, or generalized transmission coefficients, which depend oscillatorily, now not on time, but essentially on distance divided by velocity.
That's quite likely that something like this is going to happen. As I said, it is something we want to study in more detail using different approaches. We really started out with this very general approach and then played with it further. You can either do the Heisenberg equation of motion, or you can do the time-dependent Schrödinger equation for a wave packet and approach it from different ways. And in that sense, we're certainly still at the beginning of exploring the whole issue. And just one more thing you can definitely think about. Here, this thing gives you Dyakonov-Perel spin relaxation for the spin 1/2 electrons. And of course, we do expect that this approach will allow us to formulate a Dyakonov-Perel spin relaxation for whole systems also, where then most likely the quadrupole part will play the most important contribution. That is, you do not need in that context any spin splitting mechanism to get a Dyakonov-Perel spin relaxation, but all that stuff suggests that the most important contribution will be the part of the Hamiltonian doing the heavy hole light-hole splitting, which is the largest part anyway, typically. So there are many things you can further think about. So I just want to complete this. You can slightly modify this setup. Here for the corner device, you get no spin polarization at all. And of course, in spintronics, we want to have a spin polarization. And if you make such a modified device here with a 45-degree tilted region, you get these expressions now for the spin polarization within this region. And once again, the omega that appears here is always the heavy hole, light hole splitting. Yeah, and essentially all that stuff is, of course, robust against this order if this frequency we have here is larger than the spin relaxation time we have. On the other hand, we do expect that this is, of course, also a new contribution to spin relaxation in whole systems that, to the best of our knowledge, has not been discussed up to now. Yeah, this is the end of my talk. I showed you that the spin polarization of 2D whole systems in a finite in-plane field is only small. We get a sine reversal of the spin polarization at some finite in-plane magnetic field. The spin density matrix of holes is characterized by four multipoles, and the spin octupole is a new degree of freedom of these holes at a finite in-plane field. Usually, there is no exchange correlation enhancement of the spin susceptibility of heavy hole states. I did not have time to talk about a remarkable aspect of 2D hole systems on a 113 surface, where essentially, in this case, an in-plane magnetic field can give a spin polarization. I told you before that the in-plane field can't do anything, but in this particular case, it can. And then there seems to be actually a enhancement of the spin susceptibility. What one really needs is the exchange correlation energy and spin susceptibility as a function of all these four spin multipoles. We know very well how to do all these calculations without exchange correlation. It's not easy, but it's a well-defined procedure. And
so I think a naive local density type local density or proximity?
It must be spin density functional theory. That's the point.
What happens experimentally if you go over if you increase or you decrease the spinning by going from gallium nitride plus by the arsenic? Do you still see
the
crunching of the enhancement?
It is essentially based on a half experiment, half theory. I can do the calculations for the spin 1/2 electrons, including exchange correlation, and when I compare this with experiment, I find that I do need exchange correlation to describe the experimental data. That's a well-defined thing. For the whole systems, I do not know how to include exchange correlation, and I simply did the calculation without it, and it matched the available experimental data. Available meaning only essentially gallium arsenide systems.
No.
Essentially, only gallium arsenide gives you the good quality sample that you need for these low density experiments. It's just, I think experimentalists would love to work with other materials as well, but up to now, only gallium arsenide is able to do the job for them. You need the best, highest quality, low density samples for these experiments. Otherwise, you're not in an interesting regime for RS anyway.
The deep relaxation of holes is not known.
Excuse me?
The deep relaxation of holes is not known.
Diakonoff-Perel? No. You know, you can make a general statement about spin relaxation times, but you have no statement about the mechanism. That's the point. Up to now, it's no. I mean, the point is anyway that my conclusion is here, it's not the effective magnetic field due to some Dresselhaus term, but it's the heavy hole light hole term that's doing the largest contribution.
But for a practical point of view, the relaxation of the holes, the spin relaxation is quite strong, no?
It is more or less the order of magnitude. You can play with those things, say by increasing or decreasing the heavy hole light hole split in, the measured spin relaxation times of hole systems, at least for some systems, are such that we do believe it should be possible to observe this experimentally in high quality ballistic samples. The point is, you can immediately write down the formula. That's not an issue. If you say use the an approach similar to what Diakonoff-Perel did for the electrons, the important contribution is the heavy hole term, and the difference then is that Diakonoff-Perel could do a perturbative approach because the effective magnetic field is only a small perturbation of the system, and for the whole systems to begin with there is no such small parameter. And, I mean, if you have that that thing, it's fine. Yeah, we can, sure.